From NPR News.
And the time, 8 o'clock. Buffalo Bishop Richard Malone is back from the U.S. Bishops Conference, and he takes our questions when he joins us live in this hour of Morning Edition.
A new outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has claimed more than 100 lives. How can the threat be contained? I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm David Green in Chico, California. We're not far from where search and rescue teams are still combing through wreckage in Paradise, a town devastated by the campfire. We'll bring you the voices of residents who survived, and we'll take you along with one team as they look for more than 100 people who've been reported missing. It is Thursday, the 15th of November. The rapper E-40 turns 51 years old today. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. California officials say at least 59 people have been killed in two wildfires. Three people died in Southern California, and at least 56 people have died in Northern California's Butte County. NPR's Tom Goldman says many victims were in the devastated town of Paradise.
Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey says of the eight new victims recovered Wednesday, six were found in structures in Paradise, two were found outside structures. The sheriff also announced the list of unaccounted for people now is at 130. A week ago, Paradise was a quiet town of more than 26,000 residents located in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. Now much of it is an eerie wasteland of burned out vehicles and houses and buildings in rubble. The campfire began last Thursday. The origin is unknown and under investigation. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Chico.
A funeral is set for today for one of the victims of last week's mass shooting at a nightclub in Thousand Oaks, California. Ventura County Sheriff's Sergeant Ron Helas was shot and killed by a gunman after he ran inside the club responding to calls for help. He was one of 12 people shot to death. Two cabinet members and two ministers have resigned from the British government over the UK's controversial withdrawal agreement from the European Union. As NPR's Frank Langford reports from London, the resignations mark the greatest threat to Prime Minister Theresa May's leadership.
Under fire from all sides, Prime Minister May took to the House of Commons to sell her agreement.
It is a draft treaty that means that we will leave the EU in a smooth and orderly way on the 29th of March 2019. And which sets the framework for a future relationship that delivers in our national interest.
In the first hour of debate, though, no one in Commons spoke in support of May's deal, saying it didn't truly deliver on the promise to leave the European Union. In a sign of May's political peril, one member of her Conservative Party asked why he should not write a letter calling for a vote of no confidence in her leadership. Frank Langford, NPR News. London.
Officials in Bangladesh have scrapped plans to repatriate hundreds of Rohingya Muslim refugees back to Myanmar. Michael Sullivan reports no one wanted to go.
Hundreds of protesters gathered in one of the Rohingya refugee camps today, chanting, "No, no, we won't go." Others fled the camps for the surrounding hills to avoid being repatriated against their will, something Bangladesh says it won't do. More than 700,000 Rohingya fled the Myanmar military's brutal crackdown in August and September last year. Human rights groups say it's not yet safe for them to return.
Michael Sullivan reporting. 15 Western ambassadors have signed a letter asking China for information about alleged human rights abuses against minorities. It comes a day after a bill was introduced in Congress that would punish a Chinese official for overseeing alleged abuses. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And Americans for the Arts at americansforthearts.org.
A winter weather advisory will be in place at 4 o'clock this afternoon for Buffalo and the immediate vicinity. It runs until 7 o'clock Friday morning. A winter storm warning will be in place from 1 p.m. today to 7 a.m. Friday for Wyoming, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny counties. Those areas could see up to 9 inches of snow. Right now, it's dry around Buffalo. Traffic working fairly well, still slow. 190 southbound from the 290 area all the way down to the 198. And also the inbound Kensington is heavy beyond Eggert Road. Three students were arrested in connection with a bomb threat made to Williamsville North High School Tuesday. WBFO senior reporter Eileen Buckley has details.
Amherst police say three students have been charged with making a terrorist threat. In a news release, police say a 14 and 15-year-old student were petitioned to Erie County Family Court on the charge. A 16-year-old was charged as an adolescent offender and appeared in the youth part of Erie County Court on the same charge. The threat was made late Tuesday morning at the high school. Students were sheltered in place during a search of the building. Nothing suspicious was located, and students returned to their normal day. Erie County District Attorney John Flynn said he could not comment on the matter because his office is investigating the charge against the 16-year-old. Williamsville School Superintendent Scott Martzloff declined our request for an interview. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
The town of Evans Town Board met last night, the first time they've met since the announcement that the town's New Era Cap plant would be closing. Among those on hand last night was Christopher Tucker, who seemed resigned to the situation.
It's unfortunate. I think it's a sign of times. I think that the outsourcing in the country is, you know, not that great. And I think that the New Era has to keep up with the times. Its competitors, I believe Nike and Armour, are going overseas for their product.
Supervisor Mary Hausler says she hasn't been able to reach CEO Chris Cook, who is a town resident. Democrat Nate McMurray is hoping absentee and affidavit ballots will win him the election against Republican incumbent Chris Collins. WBFO's Nick Lippa has more.
Absentee and affidavit ballots continue to be counted throughout several counties in western New York. Their votes will decide who wins New York's 27th congressional district. Livingston has counted over 1,000 ballots thus far and will count over 200 more on Monday. Genesee and Wyoming County finished counting the majority of their ballots Wednesday afternoon. In Wyoming County, Collins drew 339 votes to McMurray's 269. Ontario says they plan to finish counting by Friday, while Orleans starts today at 8 a.m. All eyes, however, are on Niagara and Erie County, who make up the majority of votes. Niagara started yesterday morning counting 2,548 absentee ballots. Erie County will have over 54 absentees alone, although they won't start counting until Tuesday due to each campaign making objections on Monday. According to multiple election officials, official results can be expected the first week of December. Nick Lippa, WBFO News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green at North State Public Radio in Chico, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington. Florida counties face a deadline this afternoon. By 3 o'clock, as mandated by law, every county is supposed to complete a recount in very close races, including for senator and governor. Last-minute lawsuits and a plea from Democratic Senator Bill Nelson have not changed that, nor has news that at least one big Florida county is unlikely to make the deadline. NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid is in that county, Palm Beach County. Hey there, Asma.
Hey, good morning.
So I'm just looking at a map here. Palm Beach County, right next to Broward County. It's South Florida. It's outside of Miami. Beautiful beaches and so forth. But what's going wrong?
Well, so far at this point, they just have not been able to, it looks like, meet the deadline. I mean, it would really be a miracle at this point if they're able to do this. And part of this is that they have these machines that are older, and so they can only recount individually one race at a time. So they've got to run the Senate race first, then they're going to run the governor's race. So Susan Booker, who's the election supervisor, has really said that she's in prayer mode that they'll actually finish this.
I have to say that I'm working as hard as I can, and I can't give any more. You know what? This is our democracy, and I am here to count every vote, and I will take the time that's required. And you can see I haven't been home for 3 days.
You know, Steve, the thing is that there is this looming deadline, but for hours yesterday, there was just one machine running. And that's because on top of the fact that they have these older machines, they've also had tech difficulties with these machines. Mm. They overheated on Tuesday, and that meant that they had to recount 175,000 early vote ballots that they had already recounted. In a nutshell, though, if they're not able to meet the deadline, according to Florida law, the provisional results that they've already submitted to the state, those are the ones that are going to stand.
Okay, so that may be what we end up with in Palm Beach County, and we'll see. Other counties are turning in their recounted results. There's this 3 p.m. deadline. What happens after that?
Well, if a race comes down to being within a quarter of a percent, then there will be a manual recount. And in the governor's race, this is likely not going to be what's hit, right? So the governor's race, we're likely to see some results after today that are more official. Mm-hmm. But in the Senate race, Republican Rick Scott leads Democrat Bill Nelson by about 12,500 votes, which translates to 0.15%.
Wow.
So in a race like that, we're going to have a manual recount, most likely. It will not be all of the ballots. It's just going to be those people who had either chosen multiple candidates or who had not chosen a candidate at all. The official returns are then due by noon on Sunday. And I do want to say one quick thing, though, about a last-minute judge's ruling that we saw this morning. He ruled in favor of a challenge by Bill Nelson to give voters until Saturday to correct any issues with a mismatched signature. This decision is going to affect only Floridians who cast their ballots by mail or voted provisionally. So it's limited. You know, 4,000 plus people, it's a pretty narrow decision. But that's where things stand. That is the timeline, assuming there are no more rulings from the judge today.
Okay.
They could further delay the deadlines.
Asma, very briefly, what are you hearing from Floridians about all of this?
Yes, I have been. And really, Steve, I mean, locals tell me that they are embarrassed and frustrated. One Republican woman told me that they feel like they look like fools to the rest of the country, that people don't seem to understand really why this is happening. They feel like it makes their county look suspicious. And what I will say, Steve, is this frustration feels fairly bipartisan. And a big part of this problem, you know, people are saying is the technology, these outdated machines. The county, Palm Beach County, is planning on getting more modern machines by 2020. But overall, people want to feel like this is going to work.
NPR's Asma Khalid in Palm Beach County, Florida. Asma, thanks.
You're welcome.
Airline pilots are raising concerns about the newest version of Boeing's most popular aircraft, the 737. This comes after the deadly crash of one of those planes in Indonesia last month. We're talking here about the 737 MAX, and pilots say Boeing did not provide information or training for a critical new flight control system. Here's NPR's David Shaper.
When designing new versions of airplanes, manufacturers like Boeing want to keep many elements as similar to the previous model as possible.
Well, you want commonality for purposes of training and just ease of operations for the airlines.
Richard Abelafia, an aviation industry analyst with the Teal Group, says that helps airlines keep costs down. So Boeing plays up the similarities in sales pitches for the newest version of the 737, the MAX. But there is one critical difference in the MAX that pilots at American, Southwest, and other airlines say they were never told about, a new automated flight control system.
We had no idea, none whatsoever.
Captain Dennis Tager flies 737s for American Airlines and is spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association. He says pilots were not informed until shortly after a 737 MAX operated by Lion Air nosedived into the Java Sea October 29th, killing all 189 people on board. Indonesian crash investigators say it appears that a sensor on the plane falsely reported that the nose was too high and the plane was stalling, even though it was not. The flight control system automatically pointed the plane down, a corrective action that was not needed. Investigators cannot say yet if that's what caused the crash, but Boeing immediately issued a safety bulletin about how to regain control if such a dangerous event occurs. 737 pilot Dennis Tager calls that situation both professionally and ethically insulting.
It shakes the trust you have in the manufacturer. But why weren't we told about this?
I understand where the pilots are coming from.
Again, aviation industry analyst Richard Abelafia.
It looks like an error of omission.
Boeing does not acknowledge any such omission of critical safety information from its 737 MAX training manuals. In a statement, a spokesman says the two urgent updates sent out since the Lion Air crash re-emphasize existing procedures. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Take a look at a map of Asia, and you will see that Pakistan shares a border with Western China. The two countries have cultivated friendly relations, and in some cases, friendly personal relations. Many Pakistani men have traveled to China for business. They've met women in the Uyghur region, married, and settled down. These husbands say their wives are being detained inside Xinjiang province as part of the wider crackdown on Uyghurs, and it's tearing their families apart. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Islamabad.
Mir stands outside the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Islamabad. He's one of half a dozen men, hoping to plead their cause to officials. Mir's Pakistani. His wife is Uyghur. And until a few months ago, they lived in Xinjiang. Last August, the family came here to Pakistan for a visit. And when they crossed back into China, authorities detained Mir's wife. He hasn't heard from her since, and he says he's going mad with worry.
My mind just won't work. I sound incoherent. I even forget what to say in my prayers.
His two daughters hold his hands. He says his 15-year-old daughter is now raising her little sister. She looks cheery with painted nails and glittery shoes. But Mira says she can't sleep.
She misses her mother. She asks me, "Will you bring her home?"
Mir and others tell NPR that Chinese authorities have detained hundreds of Uyghur women married to Pakistani men. We aren't using their full names because authorities might punish their wives. The men said for a long time they were hopeful their wives would be released because China and Pakistan have a close strategic relationship. But it's an unequal one. China's one of the world's largest economies. Pakistan needs an economic bailout and wants billions of dollars in loans from China. This is Shehriyar Fazli, an analyst on Pakistan-China affairs.
The economic situation in Pakistan is such that the government feels like in order to resolve this crisis, it needs patrons.
Fazli says Pakistan doesn't want to upset those patrons. And suggesting that sensitivity, Pakistani officials refused to comment to NPR. And despite that close relationship, the wives were detained because they married men from Pakistan. Since the crackdown began, Chinese authorities have targeted Uyghurs who've had contact with people from 26 countries with large Muslim populations, ranging from Sudan to Saudi Arabia.
Pakistan is listed in that list of 26 countries where association with these Muslim countries is considered as raising the risk that these individuals were involved in some form of militancy.
And now the men say their kids are at risk. They say some of the children of these mixed marriages have been taken away on the pretext that their parents aren't around. That's what happened to Rahman. He's a Pakistani doctor who met his wife while he was studying in Xinjiang. They had a son there before moving to Pakistan. Last year, Rahman's wife flew to Xinjiang for a visit and was detained at the airport. Security officials initially took Rahman's 6-year-old son to his Uyghur grandmother. But a few weeks later, they returned.
They took him to an orphanage. They don't want the children to have Pakistani or Uyghur customs. They want the children to become Chinese.
Rahman says he hasn't heard from his wife or son since.
It's a very difficult time. My family has been broken.
We spoke to another businessman, Javed. He's Pakistani and lived in China for decades. He was married to a Uyghur woman and says she was detained in October. Then he couldn't renew his visa and had to leave the country. But authorities wouldn't let him take his two boys to Pakistan. So before he left, he told his boys he was going away for business and he sent them to live with their Uyghur relatives.
I take them to school and I tell them that I'm going to Kashgar.
Kashgar is a city in Xinjiang. But recently, a friend there told him to send $500 to his relatives, a bribe, so officials wouldn't take his children. Javed says he paid. Javed and the other men have met with officials at Pakistan's foreign ministry, hoping they'll pressure China to free their wives. But nothing's happened so far. And they say Pakistan's close relationship with China should have helped. Instead, they fear that Pakistan's dependence on its powerful neighbour leaves them helpless. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
It's 8:18 and this is member-supported 88.7 FM WBFO in Buffalo. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. And joining us now live on the phone from Baltimore, Maryland, is Buffalo Bishop Richard Malone. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jay.
Thank you very much for this time. I know you are busy going into various meetings, so our time is short, but I most certainly wanted to talk about the first development at this conference when Cardinal Donato announced that the Vatican had requested a delay in a planned vote on policy reform. Do you feel that there was a consensus among the U.S. bishops on what type of message should be sent to Rome?
Well, I'll tell you that we were all astonished and shocked, and many of us dismayed when we heard that announcement. We had come here with every intention to have some robust discussion of standards of accountability for bishops and all these kinds of things. a third-party reporting system where people could, if they knew a bishop, sadly, had abused, how that could be reported independently at the church. A lot of very important steps forward for transparency. And we were all shocked to know that the Vatican had said we could not have a vote on those things. That was our plan.
Bishop, of course, a lot of these questions perhaps you've been asked before, but it's your first time on with our audience live in this fashion. So I do want to ask you a couple of these things. You know that people here in Western New York are angry with you, of course. They've asked, called for you to resign. Those people remain angry. You've said that you're not going to resign. How do you plan to make amends to some of those individuals?
Well, I have apologized a number of times for my own missteps in handling a couple of allegations of priests accused of misconduct with adults. I have never, ever kept, and I've said this many times, and I'd be happy to go on the lie detector, I have never intentionally or knowingly kept a priest in ministry who had a substantiated charge of abuse of a minor. I have not, and I would not. So hopefully by the things we're doing going forward, we can rebuild trust. I've put together a task force entirely of competent laity who are going to prepare a protocol for how we can better handle these accusations of clerical misconduct with adults. We have a very effective, we call it the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Right.
That guides us step by step by step if we have allegation of abuse of a child or a teenager. That's a zero tolerance thing once it's substantiated. But we're kind of on our own as we work out what do we do if something comes up with a priest, with an adult. So I did not handle a couple of those as I would now. We handled them, but not adequately. So one of the great discussions we had yesterday among all the bishops, in fact, was just right around this, that we have to develop better, more effective ways to deal with this kind.
You mentioned that layperson's committee, of course, Canisius College President John Hurley among those involved with this. And it's an interesting development, but at the same time, it should be noted for those who aren't totally familiar, the Catholic Church is not a democracy. Its traditions are very hierarchical. How do you really see a layperson's committee really impacting or providing oversight for church activities?
Well, let me make a distinction. The lay committee, the lay task force I just referred to is one I established myself to come up with a protocol for adult misconduct allegations. But President Hurley and some of the other members, pretty much all of whom I know, they're very active Catholics. They have every right as baptized Catholic lay people to come together and to try and come up with a response to this crisis in our church. And I told President Hurley, he gave me a heads up on the formation of this group, and I emailed him back, and I said, you people need neither my affirmation nor my approval, but you have both, just so you know I'm supportive. We need to have their wisdom and their suggestions, and that's, I think, what they're going to be able to do. They're all good folks who care about the church and care very much about victims. We always have to come back to the priority of caring for victims. That's number one. No matter what steps we take and structures we put in place, it's all about victims.
Finally, Bishop, the question for many, and I think this goes beyond the diocese, is how was this clergy sexual abuse scandal, how did it become so widespread? How did it stay secret? James Faluzek, you may be familiar with the individual who testified as a victim in the Pennsylvania Attorney General's case. He's a former priest, and he offered this. He said that there are priests who have engaged in affairs with women, and these heterosexual affairs are well known, and because of that, a cultural secrecy has developed in that culture. Work to cloak these allegations against clergy members sexually abusing young men. Do you give any credibility to that notion?
We know there have been some forms of misbehavior that have been significant, probably through the centuries, I'm sure.
Right.
Christian theology does not shy away from the fact that all of us are affected by sin in one way or another, and that's not an excuse at all. But it's a call. This whole thing, to me, is a call to all of us, clergy and others, to really double down on our own integrity as human beings and as ministers of the church, and also the call to holiness. Unless we have a deep relationship with the Lord, that's open and ready to result in our own personal conversion of heart, we're not going to move forward.
And just
so that's the call I feel.
Sure, and then I'll just repeat that. But do you give any credibility to the idea that in some places there is a culture of secrecy that's being managed?
Well, hopefully, if there has been, hopefully that culture of secrecy will be blown out of the water by this global crisis we're in now. We have to remember that this abuse crisis is not just local in Buffalo or even in the States. It's global. China and Germany, I'm not China, Chile and Germany and Australia and Ireland, which I think may be the reason why the Vatican told us to hold off on a vote. There's a big meeting in February the Pope has called of the presidents of all the bishops' conferences of the world to look at protection of minors. So I think all of these things at that high level, plus what we're doing locally, should be a way, with God's help, to make our way through and come to a deeper integrity and better care for victims. That's my hope.
Bishop Richard Malone, I know your time is short. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for this time. God bless.
The time is 8:25, and this is Member Supported, 88.7 FM, WBFO.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. The National Book Awards had a really international feel last night. Perhaps that's because for the first time since 1983, there was an award for translated literature, and also because one of the Lifetime Achievement Awards went to Isabel Allende, who spoke about what it was like to live in many different countries. NPR's Lynn Neary went to the award ceremony and has this report.
Whether you're a debut author or an old hand at prizes, being on the short list for a National Book Award is a big deal. Christopher Paul Curtis, nominated for Young People's Literature for The Journey of Little Charlie, is a two-time Newbery honoree. But this was the first time he had a chance to win a National Book Award.
I don't know how many times I've said, who wants that award anyway? But now I know me.
Other nominees included Jennifer Croft, translator of Olga Tokarczuk's novel, Flights. Croft believes translated literature is more important now than ever.
People are needing to understand others who are different from themselves. We have a refugee crisis that's impacting the entire world, and this is something that people are thinking about and being mindful of in a new way.
The eventual winner of the translation award was The Emissary by Yoko Tawada, translated by Margaret Mizutani. Isabel Allende received an award for distinguished contribution to American letters. She, too, spoke of the international refugee crisis, reminding the audience of how quickly the world forgot the searing image of a Syrian child whose body washed up on a beach.
I write to preserve memory against the erosion of oblivion and to bring people together. I believe in the power of stories. If we listen to another person's story, if we tell our own story, we start to heal from division and hatred.
Allende spoke of feeling like an outsider, as did Elizabeth Acevedo, winner of the Young People's Literature Award for The Poet X.
I walk through the world with a chip on my shoulder. I go into so many spaces where I feel like I have to prove that I am allowed to be in that space. As the child of immigrants, as a black woman, as a Latina, as someone whose accented voice holds certain neighborhoods, whose body holds certain stories, I always feel like I have to prove that I am worthy enough.
Acevedo said it is when she meets her readers that she understands why she writes and why reading matters so much. Sigrid Nunez, who won the fiction prize for her novel The Friend, also spoke of the sense of community an introvert like herself can find among other readers and writers.
How lucky to have discovered that writing books made the miraculous possible, to be removed from the world and to be a part of the world at the same time. And tonight, how happy I am to feel like a part of the world. Thank you so much.
Other winners last night were Justin Philip Reed for his poetry collection Indecency and Jeffrey C. Stewart, who won the nonfiction prize for The New Negro, The Life of a Landlock. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And good morning to you. This is Member Supported, 88.7 FM, WBFO. A winter weather advisory has been issued for Buffalo, the immediate vicinity. Starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon, it runs until 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. A winter storm warning, though, begins at 1 today for Wyoming, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny counties. Those areas could see up to 9 inches of snowfall over the next 24 hours.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from the Lexington Co-op, Buffalo's community-owned natural foods grocery store. The Co-op helps you celebrate your Thanksgiving with fresh, all-natural, local, organic, and heritage turkeys, festive sides, piles of pies, and all the ingredients for your feast. The Co-op welcomes everyone to its tradition, Taste-Giving, on November 15th and 16th. Tasty details are found at lexington.coop. Everyone is welcome to shop at the Lexington Co-op, where local matters most.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. 8 more bodies have been found in Northern California, where the death toll from the campfire is up to 56. The latest victims were discovered in the town of Paradise, where many others were killed by the flames. More than 100 people are still listed as missing by the Butte County Sheriff's Department. Most are in their 60s or older. NPR's Kirk Sigler is in Chico, about 15 miles west of Paradise.
You know, you see people walking around with smoke masks. The smoke is so dense, and the fire is still very active. It's still growing.
More than 400 people make up teams looking for fire victims. They include coroners and specially trained members of the National Guard. The campfire is the deadliest on record in California. The number of homes lost is now close to 8,800. Police in Afghanistan say 30 officers were killed overnight in the west of the country when Taliban militants attacked them. Jennifer Glass in Kabul says it's the second attack this week targeting police in Farah province.
More than 80 Afghan security forces have died in Farah province this week as the Taliban ramp up their attacks. In May, Taliban fighters got into the center of Farah city, taking the Afghan government by surprise. Afghans are fighting the Taliban in at least 4 provinces right now, and the U.S. Special Inspector General says the Taliban control or contest 45% of the country's districts.
This is NPR News from Washington.
And this is your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO at 8:31. Major development continues to move out from downtown Buffalo. Yesterday, there was a groundbreaking for a $51 million project on the remediated land of the old Buffalo Forge site on Broadway. WBFO's Mike Desmond has more.
Developers Rhonda Ricks and Stuart Alexander say the 158 units of housing and large commercial space is just the first phase of a development on one of the largest open spaces in the city, the Forge on Broadway. As soon as the financial package fell into place a few weeks ago, actual construction started, and the ceremonial groundbreaking had to take place across the street. It's being financed by private money and an array of state aid and tax credits. Rick says she knows the site very well.
A lot of you don't know this, but I grew up about 3 blocks from here. And for about 30 years, this property stayed abandoned. But look where we are today, changing people's lives. And that's what's important.
State Assemblywoman Crystal Peoples-Stokes says she knows the site from walking past as a child, heading to the Central Library downtown. The site has already been cleaned up from its former industrial use, and that's why developers say it will open in 2020. Rick says the next phase of the project involves a series of townhouses which will be for sale, something the neighborhood wanted. There will also be senior housing. Mike Desmond, WBFO News.
In sports, college football last night, the University of Buffalo's football team blown out at Ohio University 52-17. The Bulls, though, 9-2 on the season, and they still have a chance to clinch the their conference East Division title next week. The Sabres are off until Friday night when they visit Winnipeg. Tonight in the NFL, we've got Green Bay at Seattle. A winter weather advisory kicks off at 4 o'clock this afternoon for Buffalo and the immediate vicinity. Winter storm warning starts at 1 o'clock this afternoon for Wyoming, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny counties.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from Level Financial Advisors, helping people create and sustain wealth through sound financial planning. A fee-only investment management firm in Amherst, Level Financial Advisors has developed personalized financial plans for families for 35 years. All advisors at Level are certified financial planner professionals, striving to provide a clear line of sight to retirement and financial achievement. Level Financial Advisors, helping clients reach higher. Info at levelfa.com.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world. Committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com. And from Universal Pictures, Participant Media, and DreamWorks Pictures, presenting Green Book, inspired by a true friendship, starring Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, in theaters this Thanksgiving.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm David Green in Chico, California. You know, I don't know if anything could have prepared me for what I saw yesterday. About 15 miles from here, in the town of Paradise, much of the community was incinerated by the Camp Fire here in Northern California, which is now the deadliest wildfire in state history. There are 56 people confirmed dead, but more than 100 are still unaccounted for. We spent the day in Paradise, and I just want to warn you, what you're about to hear could disturb you. We were driving around a bit with a young couple, James and Lisa Gaby. They led us in their pickup truck. There were power lines strewn across the roads. There were trees that had tumbled into the ash. They got out, and they were looking at what used to be their home.
Clara Lane, nothing left. Basically, just a bunch of rubble and metal everywhere. Cars wasted. I mean, personal belongings completely gone. I basically got out with the clothes on my back and my pickup. That's all I have.
I'm so sorry.
We knew it was coming. I mean, everybody's been saying, you know, for years, when this town goes up, it's going up, and it went up.
James and Lisa had just gotten married about 2 months ago, and Lisa was ready to give up her place in Sacramento and move in full-time with James. She loved the quiet, small-town sense of community here in Paradise.
You know, I had my normal route that I would come and come up the street, and I always knew, you know, who was out and, you know, what the houses look like.
It's a tree.
Probably
tree,
yeah.
Tree went down. That looks like the route we just came from.
Definitely not safe.
It was right over there, yeah.
This town still isn't safe enough for even residents to return, and the only reason this couple was here is because James works for the city.
I'm just glad that, you know, everybody that is in our family was able to get out in time. You know, I realize not everybody had that chance.
Agencies assigned to Group Alpha will be Napa, Plumas County, plus a canine.
There's a grim ritual each day here now. Search and rescue teams gather in the parking lot of the Tall Pines Bowling Alley, which is somehow still standing. There are California Army National Guard, there are police officers from around the state, volunteers, cadaver dog units, anthropologists who specialize in human remains. They were about to go house to house yesterday. Many of them were already suited up in white hazmat gear and face masks. They were told that once they got to houses, they should look near certain objects that may have survived, like bed springs.
Springs, bathtubs, stuff like that are kind of primary areas you want to look. They're looking for identifiable bones. We're not looking for the little stuff. So we're doing the sweeps.
We were standing right near a search team who came to volunteer from Sonoma County. Mark Aldridge is the deputy sheriff there, and he's seen this before. It was just last year that a fire in his county killed at least 22 people. The job here in Paradise right now, he said, is to look for signs of people who didn't survive and also look for anything that could be dangerous for crews who come in later.
Well, think about when you're looking for your keys. Honestly, you're looking for something that catches your eyes. You're looking something that doesn't look like it belongs. So if we know we're going into a house that it was an elderly person who was bedridden, we're going to go straight to where we think the bedroom is and find a bed frame and look there. Right now, we're just looking for obvious stuff, whether it be guns or a gun safe or, you know, that we can tell them, hey, come back and get these guns. If we find somebody deceased, we call the Butte County Sheriffs and they're going to come over and handle it. As it gets more refined, we go into sifter boxes and look for bone fragments.
Thank you. All right. Anything else for anybody? Good to the order. All right, guys. Go forth with your team.
We followed Team Sonoma and some other teams into these eerily quiet neighborhoods. I mean, it's just unimaginable to even think about. They're wandering over the rubble of what is someone's home and
It's just ash. Everything is ash. I mean, they're just pieces of metal, but it's mostly just a pile of debris, and they're going through with sticks and just having no idea if they're human remains, like, mixed in with everything else. It's just all terrible to watch.
The weird thing about fire is what it chooses inexplicably to leave untouched. I mean, 5, 6, 7 houses in a row burned to the ground, and then one still standing there perfectly. A scorched front yard, but the flagpole is fine, and so are the American flag and the Boston Red Sox flag. Fire also spared David and Beverly Lagos. We were talking to them back at the bowling alley. In Sonoma County last year, the fire came within 3 miles of their home. Now, this couple, married more than 40 years, have come together to Paradise to volunteer. We were talking to them through their face masks. David spent years doing search and rescue for the U.S. Coast Guard.
Well, unfortunately, I've had this experience before where I've seen deceased people, and, you know, you just have to take it as it is and acknowledge that somebody's passed away, be as respectful as much as possible, and move on.
So this is your wife right here, yes. 41 years?
Beverly, yes.
What goes through your mind as you're doing something so awful? Like, you're in a house, I mean, not knowing what you'll find, knowing that there are people looking for their missing loved ones. And
the main thing is if we can give resolution to the families, you know, because there are people who are worried. Where's their grandmother, their sister, their... I don't think I'm going to be very traumatized if we find remains. The main thing is that I'm going to have a little peace of mind knowing that I've given peace of mind to the family member. You know, they don't have to wonder for the rest of their lives what happened to them, where were they, did they get out? I think that's the best thing that we can all do, and that's why we're here.
But people are still desperate for a different outcome. At a Red Cross shelter down the hill here in the city of Chico, there's this bulletin board. On sheets of paper, people have written the names of their loved ones who are still missing.
You have someone looking for their daughter, and someone looking for their son, someone looking for a friend, someone looking for a girlfriend, someone looking for a sister, ex-husband, father-in-law, daughter, grandma, sister, son, dad, daughter, neighbor, she is 95. Just this list is, it's massive. And then there are a few photos of people. Here's one asking Sheila to call your kids, and it lists a phone number. This is NPR News.
And this is your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO in Buffalo. Right now, 26 degrees in Buffalo, 27 in Jamestown. One of the first major decisions made by the new leadership team at St. Joseph's Collegiate Institute was made last week. St. Joe's will be dropping Regents from its future curriculum. WBFO senior reporter Eileen Buckley recently sat down with the new president and principal to discuss their mission.
President Christopher Fulco and Principal James Spillman arrived over the summer at the All Boys Catholic High School. Fulco replaces Robert Scott, who retired. He previously served as principal of a co-ed Catholic high school in Pennsylvania. Principal Spillman returns to his alma mater. He's a 1995 graduate who most recently served as principal at a private Catholic elementary school in Massachusetts.
Both Jim and myself, we've been in a variety of different schools. I've been in an all-boys Catholic school. I've been in large public school systems. My last school was focused on students with learning differences, learning disabilities. So I have some experience with struggling learners and learners who really need out-of-the-box sort of education in order to maximize their potential. So, you know, I think that my diversity of experience will benefit. We have a very diverse student population here. We have some of the best and brightest minds in Western New York. But we have some students for whom learning doesn't come real naturally, and they need to be reached in new and different ways. And so I think that my background, coming from the diverse set of schools that I'm coming from, will really benefit our diverse student population as a whole.
As an alum of the school, this place that's
always meant a lot to me. So it's been really special to come back home and to be in this role as principal. And, you know, I think St. Joseph's always had the reputation of being one of the best schools in the Western New York area. But it's not a time to get complacent. You know, we have to keep getting better. It's just way too competitive out there. There's some tremendous private and Catholic schools, and the public schools are getting better and better at what they do. So for us, when we talk about goals, you know, there's a lot we want to continue to work on. And this, certainly the Regents' decision fits into that as part of our academic vision. But for us, it's about the entire student. How do we help our students to grow spiritually and socially in their relationships? How do we teach them a sense of empathy and compassion to think about how they live in this world? How do we inspire a life of service and a commitment to, you know, helping the people that are around them? So the goals that we've been developing are developed to foster that, so that the community that the boys come into truly becomes the brotherhood that we talk about all the time, and, you know, which can be a word that has no meaning behind it unless it's really lived out by the students. And that's, you know, our goals are developed towards, you know, building that in some positive ways.
Biggest challenge ahead for both of you?
I think, you know, the biggest challenge is getting everybody moving in the same direction. And we have so many different constituents here. We're so lucky with a 157-year history. We have so many people that care about St. Joe's. And I think for Chris and I, this first 4 months have been about establishing ourselves as the new leaders. When you're following in the footsteps of someone who'd done such great work for the school and been here for so long and was the face of St. Joe's, trying to now establish ourselves as the new face of St. Joe's, while still letting people know that that foundation is always there, that the LaSallian education that's been a part of St. Joe's here in Buffalo for so long is still there, but pushing in new directions. As I had said earlier, we have to keep changing and adapting to meet the changing needs of our students and our world. And, you know, that's not an easy task, but it's one that we're really excited about taking on.
I am following a legend in Mr. Scott, someone who poured his heart and his soul into this place for 47 years. That's a daunting challenge, but I think private school enrollment is probably the most daunting challenge that we're facing. As Jim mentioned before, there are some great public schools in the area and schools that are working to improve. We need to be the best. We need to have the best curriculum, have the best teachers, have the best extracurricular and student life experience if we want people to come here. And that's what Jim and I are working toward. We want to be the best. I think it's up to us now to create something really exciting and possibly attract new prospective families who don't want their sons to be bound by the Regents. We are on our way. I think this decision is part of our pursuit of really being the best school that we possibly can to provide a compelling reason for prospective families to choose us and pay tuition.
We've been talking with President Christopher Fulco and Principal James Spillman of St. Joe's High School. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
Attuned and aligned with her young cast, Abby of 600 Highwaymen keeps rehearsal moving. It's just a few days before Friday night's debut of Man-Made Earth at the Adam Mickiewicz Library and Dramatic Circle. A deadline approaches, but calm and focused reign as Michael Silverstone runs through preparations.
We decided that we wanted to try building things as a group. We made a list of all the things we wanted to work with, like cardboard, wood, sand, rocks.
Man-Made Earth runs this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Mickiewicz, and so does Torn Space Theater's production of Light Station. Managing Director Marissa Caruso.
It's a guided performance that moves people from the Mickiewicz to a light sculpture that is being built in the lot behind the theater. Sculpture made of 31 tons of limestone that's around 350 million years old. And then the audience moves down the street to St. Stanislaus Church, where they get to experience that sort of cathedral space in a new way and enjoy a private organ concert. These two projects are supported by the UBCAI grant.
A lot will be happening this weekend near the intersection of Paderewski and Fillmore. So for some clarity, we sought expert guidance.
It's kind of like describing an elephant. Where do you begin?
Peter Hall, co-host of WBFO's Theater Talk.
Let's face it, there's a lot more to theater than just big musicals. And that's why it's so important in Buffalo, which is a pretty arts-oriented community, to have that, what we used to call avant-garde group. That group that just takes it, you know, to the very edge. And because the stuff that Torrent Space is doing today is probably going to be mainstream maybe 10 years down the road. But it's so exciting to have it right here in Buffalo right now.
It was partially assembled on Saturday afternoon.
Okay.
A backhoe has arrived to put the finishing touches on the 31-ton sculpture of Rock and Light. Again, a lot is happening, and it's not easily defined.
It's been a challenge for us to explain what you're going to see, because we're creating it as we go. It's not like we can say, we're doing a production of Romeo and Juliet. You basically have a gist of what that's going to be like. We're creating a site-specific experience. What we can tell you is that it's going to be multimedia rich. It's going to be emotional. It's going to be a powerful, changing experience. It's going to start a conversation. You're going to want to sit in the bar at the Miskevich for the next hour and talk about it with the person that you came with.
And there is plenty to talk about. Back inside the Miskevich, Abby from 600 Highwaymen and her young cast are practicing the lines.
This is the earth, the ground, the rocks, the dirt, the pavement. This is the parking lot. Can you illuminate? Can you expand?
Adding to the dynamic, most of the actors in Man-Made Earth are from Lafayette High School. Most were born outside the United States.
Can I have your hand? Can I have a hug? Can I stay here? Can I live here with you?
It is said that art stretches the perspective, helping the observers see something new and true.
Whose place is this? Who does it belong to?
And from this perspective, 600 Highwaymen and Torrent Space Theater, with their performances of Man-Made Earth and Light Station, will give audiences plenty to think about this weekend.
Which one is your car? Can you give me your wallet, your phone, your
matches? I'm Jay Moran, WBFO News.
Jacket, your home, your neighbors, your friends. What can you teach me that you don't know?
A new job often means new clothes.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constant Contact. With hundreds of customizable email templates, small businesses can reach customers where they are every day, their inbox. Learn more at ConstantContact.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Retail sales in America went up 0.8% last month. That's quite a bit and more than expected. While it's true that hurricane recovery contributed, that is not the whole story. On Thursdays, we consult Diane Swonk, chief economist at the tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton.
Exactly. What we're seeing is consumers are finally doing something they haven't done in quite a while. They're buying clothing again. Both women's and men's clothing are picking up quite dramatically. We finally got people with jobs, and they're getting out of their gym clothes, and they're also stepping out. What we're expecting to see this holiday season is a surge in spending at full-service restaurants. It's already picked up.
Diane, did you say men as well as women are buying clothes?
Yes, men have not been buying clothes for a long time, and it is really interesting as men's clothes in particular has actually picked up more rapidly than women's clothes in the retail sales data. And that's off of very low levels, but I think it's because we're finally pulling people back into the labor force who didn't have jobs.
And the man who is arguably the most powerful single economic policymaker maybe in the world is Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, and he did an interview in which he made a point of saying that part of the reason the U.S. economy is so strong is the Federal Reserve where he works. That seemed like a message back to the president who's been critical of the central bank.
You know, Jay Powell stays in his lane, but his lane has been they've been supporting the economy. He made a point to say, listen, we've supported the economy much of the last decade, even when Congress did not. And that's something very important. And he also a bit of a rebuke to some of the criticism he's received, saying, listen, the economy's still strong. The Fed's job is to pace ourselves and not answer to any one person. If anything, the Federal Reserve answers to Congress, which Jay Powell has good relations with so that he can maintain his independence in decision-making. We know countries that don't have that independence, where politicians take over the decision-making, things go very wrong very fast.
Grant Thornton's chief economist. Diane Swonk, thank you.
Thank you.
Some numbers. The FTSE in London is little changed. Dow and S&P futures are up, but slightly. The British pound is down sharply this morning, down 1.6% to the euro. This after two cabinet ministers quit the British cabinet as the government there's their plan to ease out of the European Union comes under fire. Now, if you're not familiar with postage stamps, they tend to be rectangular and some stick by themselves without application of the tongue. I say this because in this electronic world, posting an envelope can seem quaint. I also say this because the U.S. Postal Service just released its results for fiscal 2018, showing a loss of nearly $4 billion, a loss 69% larger than a year earlier. Marketplace's Jed Kim has more.
People sent things through first class mail 2 billion fewer times last year. That's a problem for a service that is required to deliver mail everywhere, 6 days a week, regardless of snow, rain, heat, you get it. Satish Jindal is president of Ship Matrix.
Whether a letter carrier is putting 5 envelopes in a mailbox or 4, the cost is the same, but the revenue drops.
Still, those losses were more than made up for by revenues from larger things we like to order online. John McHugh is spokesman for the Package Coalition.
Package revenues now account for about 30% of all the revenues of the Postal Service.
He says that growth market and new overall rate increases set to take effect in January could help narrow the gap.
The increase of the cost of a first-class stamp will go up by a percentage, the highest ever.
To 55 cents. It'll cost more to ship packages, too. Still, many in Congress say getting into the black is more about cutting employee pensions and health benefits they say are too high. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
And Walmart stock is up 1% in pre-market trading after its quarterly results today showed store and online sales going strong.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Forex.com. Forex.com is committed to empowering and helping traders seize opportunities in the foreign exchange markets. Learn more at Forex.com. Forex.com, it's your world. Trade it. Forex trading involves significant risk of loss. And by Exact Sciences, offering Cologuard for average-risk adults over 50. Cologuard is a non-invasive colon cancer screening test that can be used at home. Available by prescription only. Information at CologuardTest.com.
With the U.S.-China trade war escalating, how do retailers like the dollar store do it? Marketplace's Rima Kreis has been looking into this. Thanks for connecting here.
Hey, thanks, David.
So in what ways are tariffs, this abstract idea, going to percolate into the cheaper stores?
So, David, if you walk into a dollar store, you would see stuff like jewelry, weird little kitchen gadgets and toys. Up to 70% of those things, not talking about food and drink, come from China. I got that estimate from Garrick Brown. He's a retail analyst at Cushman & Wakefield. He says the higher tariffs mean dollar stores have to pay more for certain products.
Which could mean that your dollar store is going to become a $1.25 store soon. Those prices will be passed on.
He says that people like me and you could eventually feel those extra costs, and not just from dollar stores. The first wave of tariffs over the summer didn't really touch consumer goods, but the second wave, the 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, touches a lot more everyday items like glassware, soaps, hats.
All right, wave number two. But President Trump has threatened a third wave of tariffs on Chinese imports. Do we have a sense of what that might do at retailers like the dollar store?
Yeah, those tariffs would, in theory, impact a lot more consumer goods. Katie Russ is an economics professor at the University of California, Davis. She told me that more tariffs would be especially tough for the dollar stores that are quite literal with their mission and have to sell every single thing in their store for a dollar.
To the degree that their margins might be slimmer, so they're trying to get the lowest cost items possible, then it may be more difficult for them to arrange alternative suppliers.
So instead of stores raising their prices, you might see even more off-brand items on the shelves or more items in smaller quantities and sizes. And David, the trade war comes at a time when dollar stores are doing well. They thrived in the years following the recession and have grown ever since, especially in rural areas. And now the tariffs, they could slow down that growth.
By the way, reduce the size of the items yet again, Rima?
I know, right?
Yeah, it'd be like a macaroni and cheese box the size of a playing card. Marketplace's Rima Kreis, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
And as part of Marketplace's I've Always Wondered series, a listener wanted an answer to this general economic meets retail meets culture question. How can the dollar store and its ilk sell things for just a dollar? Rima, that very Rima, stars in a short movie with the answer to that. It streams on the Marketplace APM channel on YouTube. I also have one, a little film, answering how come there are still humans on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
And you're listening to member-supported WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, WUBJ Jamestown, and WNED FM HD2 Buffalo. Of course, you can find us online at WBFO.org. Winter weather coming into western New York today. A winter weather advisory kicks off for Buffalo at 4 p.m. A winter storm warning begins at 1 for Wyoming, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny counties. Those areas could see up to 9 inches of snow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from The Little Market, offering artisan-made goods and home decor with a commitment to fair trade. A nonprofit founded by women to empower female artisans in marginalized communities around the world. More at thelittlemarket.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org. And from Americans for the Arts.
The Camp Fire in Northern California has now claimed 56 lives, with at least 130 people still missing. The state's governor says each wildfire is worse than the one before.